where it's time now to join J.C.T. Jennings and his friends at Lindbury Court Preparatory School as Mark Williams continues his reading of Jennings's Little Hut by Anthony Buckeridge.
M.W.B. Pemberton Oaks Esquire, M.A. Oxon Headmaster, found himself pinned to the ground by a welter of branches, bulrushes and homemade furniture as Jennings' hut caved in on him.
Are you quite all right, sir?
Asked Derbyshire timorously. Their visitor was not quite all right, and Jennings decided to take action.
Come on, Derby, we'll have to rescue him.
Soon a score of volunteers from neighbouring huts had arrived demanding to know what was going on, and their crisp comments on the situation had to be quickly and sternly silenced, for though the headmaster was not in sight, he was only too plainly within earshot.
"Buck up, you chaps, for goodness sake!"
Jennings announced, and in a lower tone he added, "He's done as much damage as 3 atom bombs already, and if he puts his foot through the ventilating shaft, we'll never be able to use it as a periscope." A minute later, Mr. Pemberton Oaks arose from the ruins and shook strayed twigs and brambles from his clothing. His feet were damp, his tie was awry, and his hair was untidy. Finally, he spoke.
"This area of the grounds will be placed out of bounds for the entire school forthwith," he began. "From what I have seen, I consider that the building of huts is not a suitable occupation for boys of your age. Your clothes are untidy, your boots are dirty, and if you are permitted to continue in this way unchecked, it will undermine the pride which you shall be taking in your personal appearance. You will all return to school and set to work with clothes brush and boot polish to make yourselves presentable."
In the dormitory that evening, Jennings found himself the centre of a swirling cyclone of resentment, summed up by Venable's unfriendly glance and comment,
"You are the most ozzard swizzler, Jennings."
"I couldn't help it," Jennings protested. "That small back room wasn't built for grown-ups, and anyway, if he'd kept still and not shoved like the back row of a rugger scrum, we'd have had him out without any hoo-ha."
Atkinson looked up from the washbasin.
"Don't make such feeble excuses. You've made a frantic bish of the whole issue, Jennings. I bet no one else's hut would have pancaked if the old man had gone inside."
Mr. Carter sat in an armchair in the headmaster's study.
"I had no choice but to put the whole area out of bounds," the headmaster was explaining. "General Meridew, his daughter-in-law, and grandson are visiting on Friday, don't forget. The general will expect to find the boys looking as smart as they did when he was a boy at school here."
"Is the grandson coming to us as a boarder?" inquired Mr. Carter.
"I certainly hope so. His father was an old Lindburian, so, of course, was his grandfather, but the decision rests with the mother, because the boy's father is stationed abroad in the Navy."
Mr. Carter had met the grandfather on several occasions. "Lieutenant General Sir Melville Meridew Bart, DSO MC, was one of the most distinguished of the old boys, and as the donor of the Meridew Inter-House Sports Cup, he was a notable figure at every speech day gathering." The headmaster strolled over to the window, where he stood enjoying the cool night air. At length he said,
"Knowing the General as well as I do, I rather think, Carter, that next Friday will be an occasion that demands something more than the normal effort. The building must be tidied from top to bottom, and the grounds swept from end to end. The boys will wear their best suits, and I shall ask Matron to see that no boy needs a haircut or wear shoes that are in need of repair."
"Yes, but if they see the school running normally, they'll be able to judge our methods for themselves, and they'll be bound to agree that the boys are very happy here. Don't you think, Headmaster?"
"I do not," replied Mr. Pemberton Oaks.
The General has a right to expect the best from his old school, and we should be failing in our duty if we did not provide it. Yes, Carter, I am determined to see that no effort is spared in making a favourable impression on General Merridew and his party. Jennings and Derbyshire were the last to reach the cricket field after prep that evening. Jennings called out loudly, "I say, you chaps, can Derby and I play in your net?" "No, you can't," said Temple curtly. His attitude plainly indicated that people who put other people to great inconvenience by building huts which folded up like opera hats onto headmasters could expect no favours. Venables and Atkinson nodded in agreement. Sorrowfully, Jennings and Derbyshire trudged away from the nets towards the hedge which surrounded the headmaster's garden. As Jennings fashioned extravagant pulls and off-drives in the air, and Derbyshire swung his arm round and round to generate the current for his first ball, Bromwich Minor sped across from the nets. "Message for Mr. Carter. He says you characters are playing too near the Archbeco's garden, and he's going to take off on a roof-level attack if you don't budge further off." "Mr. Carter said that." "Well, he used different words, but that's what he meant." Jennings glanced round the cricket field, but he could see no other suitable place where Derbyshire and he could play. Perhaps if he moved the pitch, say, 2 or 3 yards to the left, he would be complying with instructions. He knew, of course, that this was not quite what Mr. Carter had meant, but it was a move in the right direction, and anyway, the master was too busy in the nets to notice how his orders were being carried out. Derbyshire had bowled 2 overs of wides before the unthinkable happened. Suddenly, inexplicably, he pitched the ball well down the wicket and in a straight line. "Oh, good ball!" cried Jennings, stepping forward and smiting the ball with all his strength. It rose from his bat high into the air and curved away towards the hedge. "Oh, wizard stroke, Jen!" yelled Derbyshire generously. "It's going right over the..." He stopped, for a crash of glass from behind a hedge told where the ball had landed. For a few seconds, the boys stared at each other in bemused silence. Then Jennings said, "I say, Derby, did you hear anything just then?"
I fancy I did hear a sort of tinkle."
"Yes," Derbyshire admitted in a strained, unnatural voice. It was all quiet in the headmaster's garden. The sounds of the cricket field were muffled by the thick branches of yew. Quiet, but dangerous, for the garden was out of bounds. There, ahead of him, Jennings could see the headmaster's cucumber frame, and as he hurried along a path towards it, he knew what he would find. And he was right. Of the 3 panes of glass which protected the cucumbers, only 2 were intact. The middle pane was smashed to fragments, and lying amongst the cucumbers at the bottom was his cricket ball. A new pane of glass would have to be purchased, and quickly, that much was certain. Next morning, Jennings and Derbyshire sought out Mr. Carter in order to ascertain the balance in their respective school bank accounts. The news was not good. Balance in favour of J.C.T. Jennings, 4 pence. Balance in favour of C.E.J. Derbyshire, 1 penny. Still, they knew that Sunday afternoon was the only regular occasion on which Mr. Pemberton Oaks was known to enjoy a stroll in his garden. Today was Thursday. Not that there was any time to make plans, let alone carry them out, because every spare moment was taken up by tidying the school in preparation for General Merridew's visit. During break, on Friday morning, a grey Rolls-Royce purred quietly up the drive to Linbury Court Preparatory School and came to rest outside the front door. From the car jumped a small boy wearing a green pullover and corduroy trousers, and he was followed a moment later by an attractive young woman with blue eyes and fair hair. Then, from the driver's seat, stepped Lieutenant General Sir Melville Merridew, Bart, DSO, MC. Mr. Pemberton Oaks was proud of his school as he showed his visitors round that morning. The linoleum glistened and the brass doorknobs shone. Whenever they entered a classroom, a dozen boys with gleaming pink faces and well-brushed hair stood up smartly. No button was missing from any jacket, no sock hung limply round any ankle.
"Splendid, splendid. Fine body of lads, headmaster. They do you credit," said the general, who was deeply impressed by everything he saw.
At lunch, Atkinson said, "I can't imagine an old geezer like that ever being a boy at school. He must have been here round about Queen Boadicea's time, I should think." "He must have been young once," Derbyshire pointed out, "like all the chaps in those ancient school photos they've got in the attic." Derbyshire found his left arm clutched in a vice-like grip. Jennings, who had scarcely spoken since the meal started, was clutching his sleeve.
"Listen, Darby, I've got a supersonic idea," he whispered breathlessly to his friend. "It's about the cucumber frame. After lunch, we'll nip up to the attic and you'll see what I mean."
Luncheon took rather longer than usual that day, mainly as a result of the headmaster's suggestion that the school would be deeply honoured if its most distinguished old boy would care to say a few words. General Merridew stood up, and for 25 minutes repeated, almost word for word, the same speech he had made on Sports Day the previous term. The boys listened patiently, for they knew that if the speech ran true to form, it would end up with a request for a half-holiday. Their hopes were fulfilled. The half-holiday was granted, and at 2 o'clock, 77 boys filed quietly out of the dining hall and prepared for a long afternoon of cricket, photography and similar summer-term pastimes. The 78th and 79th boys, however, made straight for the attic. Jennings' plan was simple, and he explained it to Derbyshire as they pounded up the stairs. "It was you, talking about the old school photos that gave me the wheeze," he said. "The glass on one of those frames would just about fit over the cucumbers."
"Gosh, yes, massive idea. Saved at the 11th hour." Derbyshire slapped his friend on the back and danced merrily up the stairs behind him.
Once in the attic, they quickly found a frame which looked about the right size. Jennings lifted it from the wall, whipped out his penknife and slit the brown paper pasted round the edge of the frame. Then he removed a cardboard backing and eased the glass away from the photograph.
"There you are," he said triumphantly. "I'll carry the glass and you go ahead and see if the coast's clear."
Derbyshire stopped on the landing and beckoned to his friend to join him. Then he did the same thing on the next flight of stairs, and in this fashion the boys descended to the main hall. The going was more difficult on the ground floor, for there were blind corners to hamper them, but they managed well enough. Jennings crouched in doorways with the precious glass, while Derbyshire scoured ahead and looked cautiously round each bend.
"Come on, no one about," he called over his shoulder.
Jennings left cover and started in the next stretch of corridor past the library. He had gone half the distance when Derbyshire, who was peering round the next corner, suddenly waved his arms in a desperate signal to retreat.
"Get back," he breathed hoarsely. "Someone's coming. It's... Oh, golly!"
And Jennings's and Derbyshire's troubles continue tomorrow when the school's most distinguished old boy expresses a wish to look at some of the old photographs in the attic. Mark Williams was reading from Jennings's Little Hut by Anthony Buckeridge and abridged by Roy Apps. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4.